Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Lonnie Waller, and he'll be answering your most important questions on a steelheader's way. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Lonnie a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Lonnie Waller about a steelheader's way. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years, and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Well, before we introduce Lonnie, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Lonnie's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners of the drawing at the end of the show. We also will be giving away of Lonnie Waller's latest book, A Steelheader's Way, courtesy of Headwater Books. And to win this, you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show correctly. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win that beautiful book that Lonnie's just published. Our guest speaker tonight is Lonnie Waller. Lonnie has been fly fishing for 45 years and was inducted into the Fly Fishing Hall of Fame in 1997. He has pursued both trout and steelhead for over 4 decades and is considered one of the foremost experts on trophy British Columbia steelhead. His 3 award-winning videos done in 1984 for Scientific Anglers 3M on steelhead fishing have become classics and are considered the most accurate and complete treatment of the subject ever done. Lonnie has added another steelhead film to the 3M series in the fall of 2007, and it was combined with 3 original films. All 4 of these films were released in 2008 as a 4-part series called Lonnie Waller's Steelhead Legacy. Lonnie has written 2 books, A River of Dreams, published by West Rivers Publishing in 2004, and A Steelheader's Way, published by Headwater Books in 2009. Lonnie's stories have appeared in all the major fly fishing publications, and he has held editorial positions for Fly Fisherman Magazine, Wild Steelhead, and Salmon Magazine. Sorry about that. He serves as consultant to Sage Rod Company, Scientific Anglers, 3M, Rio Line Company, and Umpqua Feather Merchant. His fly patterns have been featured in the leading U.S. fly fishing magazines, and some of these are currently being produced by Umpqua Feather Merchants. Other patterns have found their way into common usage through such companies as Idlewild Flies in Portland, Oregon. Well, Lonnie, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. It's nice to be here tonight.
Well, it's good to have you, and it's always fun to talk about fishing, especially steelhead. The ghosts, right? As many people call them. Well, let's dive right in here. We'll try to cover as much of the material as possible tonight. A little bit about steelhead equipment, a lot of questions on equipment tonight, and, of course, strategies and tactics, flies, and so forth. So lots to talk about, so let's just dive right in. Well, let's just start out at the beginning. A lot of people, of course, steelhead isn't available at certain parts of the country and world. What is a steelhead for those that have never met one?
Well, Roger, I think it depends on who you talk to. Scientists have one definition of a steelhead, anglers have another. But in the broadest sense of the word, biologists classify them as a relative of the Pacific salmon. You know, and this is a genealogical thing that has to do with classification definitions and requirements. It's a, like I say, it's a scientist definition, one which I don't really put much faith in. To me, and I think to most anglers, most guys, most men and women who chase these things, a steelhead is much closer to a rainbow trout than it is a Pacific salmon. They're closer in their appearance, you know, their behavior. They're very, very trout-like, and I've always looked at them as just an overgrown rainbow trout that's born in a river somewhere, and a certain time in their lives, they wander on down to the ocean for 1, 2, 3, 4 years maybe, and they come back bigger and stronger than they were before, but they still look like a trout. They still look like a rainbow, and they act like one. They take flies like a rainbow trout. Some of them even take dry flies. So it depends on, I guess, your perspective, your sentiments, and, of course, your prejudices and opinions, because in some ways those matter the most. And I'm of the strong opinion and a prejudice that they're just really a wonderful, big, overgrown rainbow trout.
Well, now, I've never thought about this before, but does steelhead breed and make other steelhead, or is this just a rainbow trout that, you know, randomly decides to go to the ocean?
Well, it's a very interesting proposition and a very interesting question. For example, an ordinary pair of resident rainbows, male and female, who've never gone to the sea, can produce an offspring that does. Okay, and on the other hand, a mating pair of wild steelhead back from the ocean in their spawning river can produce offspring that don't go down to the sea and become steelheads. So the answer is
yes and yes.
No, yes and, no. And yes. Yeah, no and no. Yeah. There are no, you gotta throw a lot of rules out of the window when you chase these things. It's the boundaries are not black and white, they're shades of gray. So the answer is yes and yes and no and no.
Okay. Now, where do they exist in the world? I know we have them here, California, Oregon, Washington, BC, but where else do they exist in the world?
Well, they exist in the Great Lakes region of the U.S., you know, in a lot of the rivers in Wisconsin, you know, around the Great Lakes region. They have incredible runs of steelhead there. Most of those are hatchery fish that were introduced from the West Coast some time ago, but some of them are wild. They've turned wild over the years. So they have them in the Great Lakes. They have them in Alaska. They have great runs of steelhead in Russia, and they also, believe it or not, have a few runs of steelhead in Baja in Mexico. It's a kind of a secret. There's not a lot of them there. No one really chases them, but they are there, a few of them. They also have some down in Chile and Argentina, a few of the rivers down there. There's some steelhead that run out to the ocean, but no one quite yet knows the extent of those runs down there. So they're spread around a little bit, which I think is a good thing.
A question from Gil Hasen in Central California. He says, nobody's answered this question before, and maybe he won't get an answer tonight either, but
you know,
where does steelhead go when they are not in the river system?
Well, that is a good question, and no one has, again, exact answers. Of course, the Great Lakes steelhead, when they're not in the rivers, they go back into the lakes, and those are pretty easy to follow, and they can tag them and track them and chase them, you know. But the West Coast ocean-going steelhead, or they're a different beast in some ways, and their exact locations are unknown. You know, they leave the river's mouths and enter the oceans at different times of the year, and they can wander into the oceans for several thousands of miles. And they're very gypsy-like when they're out there. They're constantly moving, they're feeding, they're wandering all over the place. So their exact locations vary, and they change according to ocean currents and temperatures. So on any given day, the ocean-bound steelhead could be a lot of places, and they're very, very hard to find. That's part of the magic of them. They really are gypsies and wanderers, and most of us who love them and chase them hope they never settle down, you know. It's part of why we love them.
Well, the second part of Gil's question was, has anyone ever seen or caught a steelhead in the ocean?
Oh, yes. I've seen them in the ocean just waiting to come into the river. I don't fish for them out there, but I've seen them there. And a few people have reported casting, you know, right into the ocean at the river's mouth and hooking a steelhead there. So that can be done. They gather and they collect, you know, off the mouth of a river. Well, it's still in salt water. And
right.
It's possible to see schools of them sometimes if they prepare to come back in the river to spawn.
But generally not any further out than that. I mean, the ocean.
Yeah, they scatter. They swim at different depths at different times, so they're pretty hard to track down and to follow.
When did you first fly fish for steelhead, and how did your passion to fishing for them?
Well, the first part of that question is the easiest and the simplest. I first started fly fishing for them. Oh, it was in the late 60s, and, you know, I had fished for them for a decade before that. You know, with lures and bait and stuff. But I picked up fly fishing for them, I believe, in 65, 66, somewhere in the mid to late 60s. I caught my first one on the Klamath River in Northern California. And I guess the other part is my passion developed. It's an odd story in a way, Roger. I was really taken with them when I was a youngster, you know, and I was in high school, and I used to fish for them with my father and a couple of his friends. And I saw these things, and I got really, they were very, very interesting. I've never seen anything quite like that. So I developed really a strong curiosity and an affinity for them. And that grew and developed. The more I learned about them or found out about them, the more I grew to enjoy fishing for them and hunting them. And so the passion started well before I started fly fishing. But when I picked up a fly and a fly rod for them, that was a quantum leap forward in terms of the enjoyment and pleasure of it, which of course only deepened the passion for them. So once I picked up the fly rod and started and learned how to fly fish for them, which wasn't easy in those days, the passion was magnified and grew real strong.
Well now, you just said it wasn't easy in those days fly fishing for them, but I was just going to follow up with you and say, hasn't it gotten harder to fly fish for them since those days?
Yeah, yes and no. It's harder in the sense that in California, Oregon, and Washington, our wild fish especially have been depleted. There's fewer of them around. So you have to put in even more time now than you did 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago because they're shrinking, they're diminishing. You know, California, for example, has lost 75% of its wild steelhead in the last 45, 50 years. On the other hand, we know a lot more about it now than we used to. You know, our tackle is better, equipment is better. You know, there's been a lot of guys like me who've gone out there and pounded on the waters and told others about it. So we have a body of knowledge and traditions which have deepened over the years and which, you know, are more commonly known now than ever before. So there's two sides to that coin. There's fewer fish around, but we know more about them.
Okay, okay. And Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas wants to know, what's your favorite part about fishing for fly steelhead?
I looked at this question today when you'd sent this to me for a long time, and I thought about it, and I thought it's a great question, and I thought, how am I going to answer this? You know, because there's so many pieces to this process. But I think if I had to sum it all up, my favorite part about it are the things that I feel when it happened to me when I'm out on the river fishing for them. I feel somehow I'm where I belong, doing what I should be doing. I'm real connected to the natural world. I love that feeling, you know. You're out there and you become a part of the river. You become a part of the landscapes and the climate. You know, you blend in because you're there chasing and hunting these things. In order to succeed at that, you have to connect with yourself in a new way. And by that I mean you can't have ordinary kinds of thoughts and dreams and ideas when you're out there. You have to put your attention on what you're doing. You have to connect with all of that. So that brings me a satisfaction that I can't get in any other way. And I think that's the best of it. I'm different when I'm out there, and I think most of us are. We seem to find something, Roger, that unfortunately, a lot of us have lost along the way somehow. And when you go steelheading, it's a great way to regain that self and have it back right at your fingertips again. I think that's my favorite part.
Great, great. Good answer. Okay, we have a question. These more have to do about where. Silas Gray in Missouri. He lives in central U.S., Missouri. And where would you suggest I go for my first steelhead trip?
Well, that depends on what Silas is looking for, you know. Probably would be the easiest if he took a look at some of the stuff in the Great Lakes that would be closest to Missouri. I'm from Missouri. I haven't been there in a while, but I'm from there. I still remember where it is. So he might be, well, it might be a good idea for him to connect with someone in the Great Lakes area and try it there first. You know, they have a great fishery back there. There's a lot of fish. They're easy to catch. You know, they come at different times of the year. So that might be the easiest to do if he wants to catch, you know, to really go in, off the deep end, so to speak. He could wander out here to the Pacific West Coast and fish for the kind of steelhead we have out here. That would require more time, money, and energy. So I think he should stop and think about what it is he wants to do, you know. What is he trying to accomplish? And then decide either the Great Lakes or somewhere in Oregon or Washington, I would say.
But not B.C.?
Well, money's no object, you know, and a little bad weather now and then doesn't scare you. That's where I would go.
Yeah.
You know, you can go to British Columbia, and that's some of the best that we have left anywhere in the world. That's my favorite place. So I guess I should say that. If he really wanted to jump off into the mainstream of it, at least in my opinion, I would take a look at British Columbia.
I think another thing that maybe you can address here, especially for the first-timers, is expectations. Their first time out, and depending on where they go, I think their expectations probably need to be adjusted, right?
I agree with that. I think that's one of the key and the most critical elements in this endeavor. That should be understood up front, that success in this endeavor, fly fishing for a steelhead, success doesn't rest on numbers. It's not a numbers game in the way trout, bass, or whatever species it might be, because there's fewer of them in the river. They're not there to feed. You know, they're in there to spawn and move around. So you can't go into the steelhead game thinking like a trout or a bass angler that, well, you know, I'm going to get five or six of these today. I'm going to have a great day. That can happen. And frequently does, but it also can go the other way, and you can go 3 days without getting a bite. So you need to be reasonable about it, especially on your first trip, and understand that even on the best of days, you might only get three fish. And a lot of people go wrong. That's where a lot of anglers go wrong. They bring their old ways of thinking and believing about fishing into a steelhead river, and sometimes it pays off, but sometimes it doesn't. So it's best to go in there with low expectations. Most experts consider a fish or two a day as good fishing.
Yeah, I would say you can probably compare it to tarpon fishing, where you're happy if you get one a day, because it is more of a hunt rather than a lot of catching.
Right, there are exceptions to that. I mean, you can have days in the Great Lakes where you can catch 10 steelhead in a day or 12 steelhead in a day. That happens there in some of those rivers. So that's one exception to that. But on the West Coast out here, you know, we don't have those kinds of expectations.
Right, right. Another question, Josh Wainwright in Cabin John, Maryland. Says his wife and he will be out in B.C. in September. I'm a fly guy, but she spin fishes. And he wants to know, can you do float trips that, will anybody take them both?
Yes, there are other guides and outfitters who can do that for them. You know, the two forms of fishing are compatible, assuming the guy and his wife are getting along, all right. You know, the fishing's fine. Then, you know, he could get in contact with some of the Oregon, Washington guides and outfitters, and they can arrange float trips. They do that on the Deschutes River, the Grand Ronde, and some other streams where they can float and fish with both kinds of gear. They do it on the Rogue River. So that stuff's available.
Okay. One more question, and then we'll take a break, and we'll talk about equipment right after this. Pete in Southern California says, what do you recommend to a novice starting out fly fishing for steelhead? Any just kind of general recommendations you can give?
Right. I think, I assume that when he says, what do you recommend, that means equipment. I'm not quite sure if it means equipment, location, or time of the year or whatever, but...
Just to do a trip, you know?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
You know, maybe an overall trip.
That's a good way to look at it, and perhaps that's what Pete means. Well, yeah, I think he should find someone, a guide or an outfitter who's experienced, who's been in the game for a long time, and get your introduction and start that way. You'll learn more with an experienced guide or an experienced angler, if you have a friend or whatever, who's gone through the ropes, who knows the basic elements of the game, and you'll pick up more from that kind of situation than you would 3 years on your own. So I would recommend that a novice find someone who's not a novice and make sure you get the right start.
Okay, great. Well, we need to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Lonnie about fly fishing for steelhead. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take an advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call them at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Lonnie Waller about a steelheader's way. If you'd like to ask Lonnie a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Lonnie, before we dive back into the questions, tell us a little bit about what's happening in your fly fishing world right now. I know you just finished a wonderful book. So tell us a bit about your book and the other things you're up to.
Well, I worked 3 years putting together sort of my picture of what all this meant, you know, what I had experienced, what I'd seen over the years. So the book was a big part of my journey, I guess. It was a way for me to share experiences, ideas, you know, opinions and facts that took me decades to either beg, borrow, steal, or learn on my own. So I thought about all this, thought about it, and I started working on the book, and 3 years later, you know, it's out. It's been very well received. I was a little surprised about that, but quite happy about it, because in some ways it has been a way of life for me. I have other activities. I have a business. I have a wife and a home and all of, you know, the usual stuff that guys have. But I also had a part of my life that was really committed to this kind of activity, this kind of fishing. And the book was a way for me to pay a tribute to that, to those who came before me and to the younger generation of these great anglers that we've got coming along now. So really, that was a big thing for me, just to put in my two bits worth and become just a part of something that I'd been watching for many, many, many years. I still travel. I do a lot of fly fishing travel, not only for steelhead, but saltwater, and I go to New Zealand every year to chase trout. So I'm keeping all that stuff alive, you know, even now after 35, 40 years in the business. I'm still out there, like everybody else, pounding on the water, you know, trying to reinvent myself, you know, as an angler, and just staying involved, you know. It's something I love and something I don't want to give up.
Now, you have a website where you sponsor, you know, advertise your trips and so forth, right?
Right, yeah.
What is that website?
That's www.lonniewaller.com.
Okay, lonniewaller.com. That's
yeah.
Lonniewaller.com.
That's right, Roger. Yeah, they'll find me.
Okay, good. Well, I'm sure they'll enjoy your book. And anything going on in conservation?
Oh, lots of stuff. Yeah, these are uncertain times, Roger. And the steelhead are a little bit like the canary in the mine in the sense that, you know, I mentioned earlier, California, for example, has lost 75% of its wild fish since they started documenting runs about 50 years ago. There's stuff going on that, you know, it's a little scary for those of us who grew up when things were still plentiful, when fishing was really good and the wild steelhead and salmon were plentiful. A lot of us are worried about that. We're losing our wild steelhead, our wild salmon, you know, especially California, Oregon, and Washington. And less so as you move further north into British Columbia and Alaska, but there's some really scary stuff going on there too. You know, we live in an age in which there's greater demands on our resources all the time. We need more raw materials, we need more mines, more trees, more dams, more of all this stuff. And our steelhead and salmon have taken a real beating. Just the other day, California, for example, announced that they were suspending all their commercial fishing for salmon. The runs are so seriously diminished. So all of us out here in the West Coast are watching this really closely because this is something new. You know, we've had times in the past where, you know, you have a good year one year, a bad year the next. But there are things going on in the world today that are bigger than that, and they seem to have greater long-term potential. So for real serious problems. So we're all watching that. Most of us who are in this endeavor are also participating in conservation organizations, you know, to try and slow this down, try to save what we've got before it really would be too late.
if people wanted to get involved or help with that, are there any particular organizations you'd recommend?
There are. On a national sense, organization, Trout Unlimited has done a marvelous job. They're in the thick of things. TU, they're called. They have a website, Trout Unlimited. Anglers on the West Coast in California have Cal Trout, you know, that works on California cold water fisheries. There's stuff up in British Columbia on the rivers up there, the North Coast Steelhead Alliance. So there are groups around who have gathered together and formed relationships and alliances with each other. And there are some successes too. It's not all bad news. And if people want to help, there's plenty out there to do, because successful conservation takes time, money, and energy. So most of us have at least one of those we can contribute.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's dive back into the questions. We did get one more question about BC here on the internet.
Okay.
Mike Lacey asked, what rivers in BC would you recommend that are good for first-time, non-guided, do-it-yourself anglers?
Well, a lot of that action goes on in the Skeena system. You know, they have rivers up there that, like Kispiox, the Bulkley, the Copper, you know, the Maurice, there's a little bit on the Babine. Those Skeena systems, they have a pretty well-developed system of roads and B&Bs that you can stay out for a modest fee. You know, you don't have to fish at $1,000 a day lodge. So those BC rivers get a lot of that kind of fishing every year in September and October. That would be probably the best of it, because the access up there is pretty good, and yet the fishing is still also excellent. So I'd take a look at some of those rivers.
Okay, great. Okay, we've got lots of questions here on equipment. Seems to be a hot topic.
You know how anglers are, Roger. They're addicted to tackle. I'm going to love this part of the show.
Yeah, just when you think you have every rod you need, then. And in fact, we do have a rod builder on here kind of asking, what is the next rod I should build?
I'm going to tell him. I saw that question. I'm going to answer that. I'm going to tell him exactly what to do.
Okay, good. Well, we might want to lump these together, but just to give credit,
sure.
We've got Randy in Tennessee, Jack in Wyoming, and Doug McLean, and Doug's a great fly fisherman up there in Calgary, Alberta, on the Bow River, asking about rods. So let's talk about rods, both spay and regular rods, and kind of give us an overview of your thoughts on that.
This is a favorite topic of mine, too. Fishermen all seem to have an addiction for gear. I don't know what it is about the sport, but we all love it. I've never outgrown my love of it either. So if we start with the big picture, you know, some general things, I would say if you want to fish a single-handed rod, I would choose one from, say, 9 to 10 feet long. You know, I like them a little bit on the longer side than, say, an 8 or an 8.5-foot rod. I'd go with one from 9 to 10 feet long. They move more line very, very easily than a shorter rod will. They mend better. You can fish them better. So I would choose a 9 to 10-foot rod, nothing less than that, and certainly nothing more. You want to avoid extremes. And the same thing is true of the two-handed rods. When you're first getting started, the worst thing that you can do is use the kind of rod that I like, a short little rod, say an 11-footer. They call them switch rods. Those are not good to learn with, because the timing for two-handed rod, that short, is critical. And no one starts off with good timing. So don't do that. On the other hand, I don't like the 14.5 and 15-foot rods either. They're too big and too heavy. And in my book, I told the reader that really the only thing they're good for is beating bears up. You know, I don't like those big, long, heavy rods. They're uncomfortable. They're over a long day of fish. They cast a long line. They do that. They move a lot of line. You know, a bad cast with a long rod goes 40 feet with, you know, the two-handed rod. But I don't think they're any fun. And they're going to wear a beginner out. So I would tell a two-handed rod fisherman who's just beginning, get a 13.5-foot rod, and you'll be right in the money. And you can learn with that one. They're easy to learn with. They won't wear you out. And then later on, if you want to go to a 15-footer or an 11-footer, you can. But don't learn on those. Get that 13.5, maybe a 14-footer to learn on.
Now, advantages, disadvantages between a single-handed versus a double-handed rod?
Well, you know, I hung on to a single-handed rod well past the time when a lot of other guys had made the switch to two-handed rods. There are some advantages to a single-handed rod. They're lighter in the hand. They're less fatiguing in some ways because they're shorter length. You see, a rod, fly rod, is both a lever and a spring. And the longer the lever arm is, the more pressure it puts on your fulcrum, which is your wrist. You see, so the shorter single-handed rods, they're lighter in weight. They put less stress on your wrists, you know, once you learn the basics of casting. They're a lot of fun to hook and play a fish on because they transmit a lot of the fish's energy and motion up through the line, so they're a real feely kind of a rod. So they offer that advantage, but the advantages of a two-handed rod are also very real. They mend and control the fly line once it's in the water much better because they're longer. You know, you can reposition your line when it's swinging through the currents with a long rod in a way that you can't with a short rod. You can use a two-handed rod when you're right back up against a tree or a cliff because you don't have a back cast, you see. So I think both have their advantages, and even though the two-handed rod has taken the current steelhead rod by storm, there's still a few real cool hands out there who show up with their single-head rods, and they do really, really well. So I'm not trying to beg off on the question, but each has its advantages and disadvantages. And it depends on the kinds of water you're going to be fishing, you know, the kind of lines you like to use and the kind of flies you like to use. If you like to use big, heavy lines and big flies, then the two-handed rod is better than the single-handed rod because it'll handle heavier lines and bigger and heavier flies. If you're fishing on a smaller stream where you have smaller and lighter flies, lighter lines, then all you need is a single-handed.
What about as far as accuracy is concerned in cast?
That's usually not near the top of the pile. Usually you're casting to a target. It depends if you can see the fish. If you're fishing on a small stream or even on a large one and you can see the steelhead, then accuracy really matters because you want to get your fly as close to the fish as you can. Most of the time, you know, you can't see them, and you're searching a big section of the pool, you know, or the riffle or wherever you're fishing. So accuracy really doesn't come into its own in a real specific sense. You know, you want to be able to look at the best part of the riffle that you're fishing or the run and get your fly out there, but since you can't see the target, you don't know where to specifically aim your cast. You're just trying to put your cast in a section of the river that looks good and let the currents then drift your fly into the fish, wherever he or she may be. But normally accuracy, in the ordinary sense of the word, doesn't really enter the picture.
Okay. Well, without having to read Dennis's full, Dennis Freeman in San Antonio, Texas, his explanation and ultimately his question, basically, he's a rod builder that sees possibly the need for a rod to be built, but also is real sensitive to gearheads who, you know, you don't want to buy a 14-foot, 15-foot rod and have it sit in the closet most of its life. You want to get the most use out of the equipment you have. And I think he was looking for your opinion on this, so you've been thinking about this, so what do you have to say?
Well, I'm reading through his question now, and there's a lot to it. It's a lot of points in his questions. As I understand it, he said he's eager as any of the rod manufacturers to promote something new, but promoting 14 and 15-foot rods will seldom get used, makes him a bit uncomfortable. He says, I'm confident the bulk of the steelhead you've landed were on traditional 9-foot rods. You know, that's all true. I think the truth of it is that there's a lot of ways to succeed at this. There's a lot of gear that's good, and people along the way pick up and discard many, many rods in their career. And there's been very few times in my life when I've fallen in love with a specific rod for steelhead. It's happened twice, you know, and maybe he needs to think about, Dennis needs to think about just exactly where and how is he going to use this rod. I would say if I had to pick one two-handed rod to do anything with, he even mentions fishing on the Gulf Coast, you know, I would use a shorter rod, the 11 to say a 12-foot rod. I think that's the future. If there is a future, a specific future in the two-handed rod process, it's already started and it's been going on for a while, and that is people are gravitating away from the 14 and 15-foot rods to the 11 to 12-footers, and for good reason, in my opinion. And he might want to take a look at something like that as a great all-around rod, even for, you know, fishing out on the saltwater flats down there somewhere.
Right. Well, good. Well, let's take a quick break, and then, Lonnie, when we come back, let's talk about lines and leader setups and explore that. So when we return, we'll talk with Lonnie more about a steelheader's way. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan, providing year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit www.pm, as in Pere Marquette, pmlodge.com, or call 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Lonnie Waller about a steelheader's way. If you'd like to ask Lonnie a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so we talked about rods. Anything you want to say about reels before we dive into lines and leaders?
Yes, I got a few prejudices about reels. See, well, I fish on rivers that have a lot of big fish, and that means fish that can even be over 30 pounds. Sometimes you hook them real close to some bad, rough water. So I want a lot reel that has a decent drag, smooth drag on it. And I don't like, with all due respect to the many makers out there who build the cork disc drags, I don't care for those as much as I do a seal drag because they require more maintenance than I'm willing to invest. You know, the cork gets wet or dirty, it can slip and grab or stick. There are some wonderful ones out there that are beautifully machined, but I'm a bit lazy, getting lazy in my old age, and I don't want to spend a lot of time tweaking my tackle. I just want to use it. So I started the last 5 or 6 years especially, I've insisted that I fish only with reels that have a sealed drag. There's several of them on the market, but the one that Sage Rod Company builds is an absolute gem. You don't ever have to lubricate them. You never have to worry about them. You can go swimming with them. You know, you can throw them in the freezer, and they're fine. So those are my favorites. I also think you want to reel with your, I want to reel with my dominant hand, which is my right hand. So I want reels that I can right hand wind reel so I can recover a lot of line quickly. And I like a large capacity, you know, especially if you use a two-handed rod because the lines are thicker for a two-handed rod and you'll need a little bit larger reel. So I want a sealed drag, large capacity, you know, and one that I don't have to worry about or when I'm fishing. I can just fish.
Now, before we talk about lines and leaders, one thing I don't think I heard you say, if you did, I missed it. When you were talking about rods, you were talking mainly about length and not weight of rods. Do you have any preferences on the weight of the rod?
Well, yeah, lighter is better. I mean, and the rod makers are doing some absolutely miraculous things with materials now, you know. I mean, my favorite rod is that Sage 11-foot switch hitter, they call it a switch rod. You know, that thing's just a few ounces. It's like a feather. So lighter is better. You know, I said a few minutes ago that a rod is both a lever and a spring. And, boy, you get that heavy old lever out there in front of you all day long, making, you know, steelhead have been called the fish of 1,000 casts. And lightweight makes a difference. So the lighter they are, the better I like them.
Okay. And then what about line? Floating line? Do you ever use sinking tip?
You could write a whole book on lines. I think in some ways they are, in my opinion, the line is the single most element in your arsenal of equipment because it's the line that takes the fly to the fish. The rod may throw it out there, but the line is the tool that brings the fly to the fish. So I'm a line nut, and day in and day out, in my opinion, there is no choice other than a weight forward line, you know, where it has a casting belly followed by thin shooting or running line that has a loop on the end of the casting belly where you can add and change interchangeable tips of different densities. That was a revolutionary development and one that, to me, has been at the core of all the great modern advances. It's been these interchangeable lines where you can take a 15-foot tip, you can put one on there that floats and fish a dry fly. On the next pool just around the corner, you can take that off and put on a heavy sinking tip that's going to get your fly down in 5 feet of fast water. And that kind of line will do more for you in one day than any other piece of gear you can get, including your waders. So there's no doubt I obviously have strong ideas about this. And I wouldn't dream of going anywhere anymore without those interchangeable tip lines.
Any particular manufacturers you favor there?
Well, there's several good ones out there. My favorites are reel lines. Those guys that design those lines are fishermen, you know, and they know what it takes to build a great line because they fish, and they know the demands of steelhead fishing. They know what you have to do, and they look at lines as what they really are. They're problem solvers. So the reel lines are exquisitely manufactured, they're absolutely perfect, and they're designed by guys who fish. So I've got a ton of them.
Okay. Just looking at some of the other questions that came in, I think some of these we've covered, will cover. Okay, we've got Treg in Idaho, wants to know what leaders and tippet do you recommend? Can you tell us how you rig up for
it? Yeah, it depends on the circumstances under which I fish, you know. You know, you have to remember that terminal tackle is designed to solve problems. And you have one kind of problem on a small little stream that's 20 feet wide, and you've got another problem on a river that's 165 feet wide. And the general rule would be this. The smaller the stream is, and the lower and clearer the water is, you know, the more you have to think of steelhead as kind of acting like trout. This means the problem there is they're spooky, they might be able to see you, you know, so that means then you're going to use a longer and lighter leader, much like a trout leader even. So, for example, if you're a Great Lakes fisherman and you're fishing on a steelhead river in upstate New York or Wisconsin somewhere, you might want to use a 14 or 15-foot leader tapered down to, say, 6, 8, 10-pound test, not that different from a trout leader. On the other hand, if you're wading through some of those big rivers on the Pacific Northwest, you know, and you're using big flies and heavier lines, your leaders are very, very simple. And mine are nothing more than a 3-foot piece of 15-pound test monofilament. They're not tapered. There's no tippet. There's no butt section. It's just I just peel off 3 or 4 feet of a monofilament off of a spool and loop it onto the end of my fly line and tie it onto the fly. So leaders are designed to, someone once said the leader should be long enough to fool the fish and short enough to cast.
And what you just described, that short section of leader, straight, non-tapered, there you're letting your line do the work of getting the fly to where they're at.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I meant earlier. Yeah, it's mostly the line's job. I mean, you can help it, but it's the line's job to get the fly down there, and it's the leader's job to fool the fish. And sometimes, you know, under certain conditions, I know of successful fishermen who fish with a leader that's not much more than 18 inches long when the fish are big and dumb, you know, and there's not a lot of fishing pressure. On the other hand, you can fish in places where a leader like that and a line, you know, a leader that short would scare any fish within 100 yards. So look at your conditions and choose your leader accordingly.
Okay. Let's talk about flies, unless there's anything else you want to comment on equipment.
No, just, you know, get all you can. Everybody in the industry. Get all your wife will let you have. And if my wife says anything, I go to the closet where she keeps all of her shoes, and I just kind of open the door, and I look in there, and everything's fine, you know.
And everything's fine. We're even again, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about flies. What are some of your favorite steelhead flies and why?
It depends, again, on where I'm fishing. And here again, the flies you choose should reflect the conditions and the circumstance of where you're fishing. For example, you know, if you're fishing a tidewater pool in Northern California for winter run fish, you know, and the water's low and clear, you know, we've used flies as small as 12s and 14s, trout-sized flies. Other places, like in British Columbia, I use flies that are 3 and 4 inches long. So it depends on how spooky the fish are, how much fishing pressure there is, and how low and clear or high and dirty the water is. So here again, the choice of your fly is never arbitrary. You know, colors, we can get in that in a minute. Colors is more arbitrary than anything, but the size and the weight of the fly isn't. So if you're fishing a smaller stream, you know, with lower current flows, don't use those real big flies. If you're on the Kispiox or the Babine or the Sustut or the Clearwater in Idaho, you know, and the river's 150 feet wide, you know, you can use a bigger, longer fly. So my flies for that kind of fishing, which is most of what I do now in the bigger rivers, the flies are 3 to 4 inches long. A tarpon would take them, but the steelhead like them. And, you know, they're easy to tie and fish, and I can see the eye that I put the leader through now, you know. So those are my favorite ones ordinarily. But you want to match your fly to the condition, so that usually means size more than anything else. I think color is a secondary consideration, but here again, flies have almost become amulets in a way and magic potions, so to speak, and everybody has their favorite, as do I. So that's part of the game too, you know. Someone once said that it's harder to find a fly that a steelhead won't take than it is to find one they will take. And there's a lot of truth in that. So use one that you believe in that matches the conditions under which you fish and go find one. Go find a steelhead.
One of the questions, Tim in Moscow, Idaho, says, and this is kind of, you know, along the lines of what you're talking about, he says he's heard the adage, bright days, bright flies, dark days, dark flies. Is there some rule of thumb you recommend or use when selecting a fly to use?
Well, that expression has been around since I was a kid, and the truth of it is it's not as ironclad as most think it is. I learned this years and years ago when I fished with a guide, you know, who said, hey, if you want to catch fish in muddy water, use a pink fly. Well, you know, and I'd always thought that dirty days, dark water, you know, you wanted black. So I thought, well, I'll indulge this guy and, you know, put on his pink fly. Son of a gun, it worked just as good as any dark fly I have ever used. So I think that that rule holds more water, no pun intended. You know, the color of your fly matters mostly to me only under two circumstances. One, you know, depending on the clarity of the water and how much fishing pressure there is. If the water's glowing clear and there's been a lot of fishing pressure on the river, I'm not going to go out there with a big, bright, gaudy fly. I'll choose something small, more trout-like, more somber in its coloring. You know, and then on the other hand, if I'm fishing in a wilderness river where there's not a lot of pressure, the fish are big and dumb, you know, my flies are 4 inches long, some of them. And the color I paint, the only time I pay attention to color is if I'm fishing behind someone, you know, there's two of us on the pool and we're moving downstream as we fish. And if that person is a decent angler and they're using a black fly, I'm not going to come behind them with a black fly, because if they're a good angler, the chances are if they don't take that person's black fly, they're not going to take mine. So then I worry about what color. I use a different color. You know, or if I fish through a pool and I haven't caught anything with a black fly, then I'll go back upstream and come down again a second time with an entirely different fly. So that sounds like kind of a roundabout answer, but here again, it depends on what's going on, and color is usually not at the top of my concerns. You know, I worry more about the size of the fly and the condition of the water.
Now, in the scenario you just talked about, where you fished a section, you go back, how often would you switch up? I mean, how often are you switching flies if you're not getting any action?
Yeah, that's a good question. Normally, if the fish are, you know, normally you should be getting some action. If you know what you're doing, you know where the fish are, you know how to present your fly, you should be getting some action. And I normally only change flies if I've gone through a pool that I know it just looks so good, it just has to be a fish there. And if I go through with a black fly, let's say, and I don't hook anything, then I'll go back up and try a different color fly. You know, or if I get a strike out there and I don't catch, I don't hook him, but I know it was a steelhead, and I make that same cast with a fly again, they won't take it, then I change my color then. Because sometimes you can change their mind with a change of color, but, you know, it depends on the circumstances of that. So when you choose your first fly, you know, fish it hard, and if it's not producing something, and you know there's fish there, you know, you can either see them or you know they're there. You know, you can see them rolling or splashing, or you just know they're there and you don't get anything, change then. Because sometimes they do seem to turn on to a change in color. But I make less of this than most guys do.
Okay, okay. So in all of this, you haven't specifically stated a name of a fly or a design of a fly. Am I getting the drift that anyone will do? Again, being selective about your situation.
Yes, pretty much anyone will do. Yes,
okay.
They will. You know, I'll tell you the thing about flies. People should know this. I learned this the hard way, and it took me years to do it. The most critical part of the fly is the hook. Okay, size and color, you know, marabou or chicken hackle or bear hair or whatever it is, that stuff's all fine, but it's the hook that I worry about. And to me, that's the most important part of the fly, because they'll take almost any fly. I mean, you know, it's not like trout where you have to find out exactly what kind of fly they're taking because you're trying to match a specific insect or animal. It's not like that. You're just looking for something that'll trigger their response, and there's thousands of flies that'll do that. What you want to worry about is how well will that fly hook the fish, because the hook is the most important part. So my flies now are tied on bait hooks. They're not tied on fly tying hooks. I tie them on bait hooks, and the specific brands, I like Umpqua, makes some good bait style hooks. And what I mean by bait style is they have an offset point and a chemically sharpened point that's so sharp you're afraid of them. You know, that offset point is absolutely critical on a fly, because when a steelhead takes the fly and it closes its mouth down on the fly, 9 times out of 10, the fly will roll over on its side, right? I mean, he's pushing down on the hook, so the hook falls down on its side, clamped down within the jaws of the fish, and when you try to hook a fish like that on a straight point, it oftentimes just slides through out of the fish's mouth. But if that point of the hook is pointing down, or up, it doesn't matter. You know, as long as it's offset to one point and you pull on it, it's going to stick. And my hooking to landing ratio went from about 60% when I switched to those chemically sharpened short shank bait hooks with an offset point. If I hook 10 fish now, I'm going to land 8 or 9 of them.
You might have just given out the best tip of the night right there.
Well, it's a good one. I learned it the hard way. I watched
it
a lot of...
It makes total sense to me, you know, when you think about it. It makes total sense.
Because when you pull, when that fly's rolled over in the fish's mouth, you know, the point of the hook is in line with the shank of the hook. You're pulling everything in a straight line.
Right.
But if that point protrudes to one side or the other, it's like a blade of a plow. It's going to instantly dig.
Yeah. Now, what about, I talked to some fly tiers a couple of years ago here in Denver at a fly tying expo thing, and they were all hot on the tube flies with the trailer hook on it for steelhead,
mm-hmm.
and that seemed to be the best thing going back then, because they were claiming that steelhead strike short a lot, and I've talked to other people that say that's a bunch of bunk. So what's your take on that?
Well, I'll probably tell people more than they really want to hear about this, but the tube flies are a great design. I use them almost exclusively with the offset short shank hooks we just described.
Okay.
Now, tube flies have been around a long time. They were invented and created by Atlantic salmon fishermen, you know, almost 100 years ago, but steelheaders picked up on them pretty late in the game. I got onto them about 15 years ago. And the reason why I like them is that sometimes steelhead strike short for two reasons. One, they're not completely fully aggressive. You know, they just sort of take an instinctual sort of response to the fly. Or the water's really cold. Those are the only two kinds of steelhead that strike short. Ones are in cold water, or those ones who just decided not to slam it for whatever reason. So the advantage of the tube fly is the hook is at the rear of the fly. So if they do strike short, you know, you can't hook them with the wing of the fly. So if you've got a long wing on a short hook and they do strike short, all they're doing is clamping down on the fur or the feathers. But if the hook is back there, you've got a better chance of converting even the short takers. So the tube flies or the stinger type. And there's a great chapter in my book, pardon the plug here, but where I go into fly design and what really matters and what really doesn't. And those tube flies and those stinger type flies, that's all I see anymore.
Okay.
It's not that they attract more fish, I think, than a traditional fly. They just hook them better.
Right, right. And when you only get a few chances a day, potentially, you
oh
don't
boy.
Want to miss one. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. There's nothing like going 3 days and getting one strike and not hooking them.
Yeah,
that's a lot of fun.
You had mentioned just about any fly would be attractive, but there were two specific questions here from Dan in Illinois and Dick Barnett in Fredericksburg, Virginia, asking about nymphs versus streamers. Comments on that?
They both were. I prefer streamer-type flies because I'm fishing mostly on what we call, you know, the downstream swing, a swinging fly. You know, and a long streamer-type fly looks better, acts better on that kind of a presentation. Nymphs, in my opinion, come into their own either on small streams where the trout or the steelhead are scared to death and they're acting like resident trout. You know, or when the water's real low and clear and you use a nymph with an upstream dead drifted presentation with a strike indicator. That can be deadly. I don't like to fish that way. It's not much fun. And I only do it if I'm absolutely forced to, which is almost never. But the nymph really comes into its own when the fish are heavily pressured and those swinging flies, all the fish in the river know what they've learned about them. They know their trouble. And then you go out there with a smaller nymph, you know, and you throw it upstream and let it dead drift back like you're just fishing for trout, look out. That can be deadly. So I would limit my nymph fishing to those kinds of conditions. Tough, low, clear water, heavy pressure. Then sometimes those swinging flies, they just don't cut it anymore. And the wise guy, the smart angler, will try some dead drifted nymphs on a floating line. Just like you were fishing for trout.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take a quick break again, but then when we come back, we'll talk about some tactics and strategies here. So hang tight, folks. We'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. We hope to hear from you soon. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Lanny Waller about Steelheader's Way. If you'd like to ask Lanny a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, there was one other fly kind of question, and Kevin in Plainfield, Illinois wants to know, do you ever use spoon lures, hardware, on your fly rod?
No, I don't. It works. I've seen it in action. I know it really works, but there's really no need to do that, so I don't. But years ago, I knew a fisherman who always caught fish, and I could never figure out how he could do it because he couldn't cast. He didn't know how to read water. He was sort of a disaster out there, but this guy was always catching fish, see. So one day, we were fishing on the same pool together, and I thought, you know, I'm going to take some time out here. I'm going to go up and watch this guy fish. I'm going to learn something. So I put my rod down, started hiking through the woods to get up where he was fishing, and I just was ready to break through the trees and come out into the river he was fishing, and I saw him with this fly dangling off the tip of his rod, and he had it tied on to a big Colorado spinner blade. I didn't say anything. I just melted back into the woods and went back down and went through my piece of the river again. I don't think it's a moral sin, you know, to do hardware spoons on your fly rod. In fact, they make some fly rod type lures out of plastic materials that are as light as a fly, and they really work. But that's, to me, it's a little bit out there in outer space, so I just don't go there. But okay. I know some good people who do.
You devote a whole chapter to this in your book, and the title is Why a Steelhead Takes a Fly. Do you want to talk about that a bit before we get into the strategies here, or maybe you can combine that with some strategies?
Well, yeah, they're obviously related. Well, I've thought about that for 50 years, you know, and here's what I've come up with. I think they take a fly because of the imprinted need to eat, you know. As soon as they're hatched, I've watched little baby fish hatch, and 2 days after they hatch out from the gravel, they're already feeding. Now, these little guys feed for 1, 2, 3 years in the river, and then they go out in the ocean. They have to keep feeding for one simple reason. If they don't eat, they die. Okay, it's as simple as that, and it's complicated. So when they come back into the river to spawn 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, whatever it is, and they've been eating their whole life, to me it seems obvious that when they see something in the river that looks like food, even though they don't have to have it in order to survive, you know, that instinct is so strong that they at least take a look at it, you know. And I know they do some feeding in the rivers. I've seen them. I've seen steelhead eating salmon eggs. I watched the eggs go into their mouth. I watched them take caddis and mayflies from the surface. And these are big steelhead, 12, 14, 15 pounders. So I know they do some feeding, but I don't think they have to do that in order to survive. It's part of this instinctual response. That's why I think they take them.
Okay.
You know, some have added, well, maybe they'll take a big, long swimming fly out of a territorial, you know, and that makes some sense to me. If I was a fish and I was happy in my little bed there and I saw this 4-inch thing swimming into my place, I might want to get rid of it too. So I might add territorial protection or, you know, that kind of response there. But I think most of it is an imprinted response.
Okay, let's talk about finding the steelhead and the type of water they hold in. You know, you just come up on the stream, and say you don't have a guide pointing you at the best spot on the river. What are you looking for?
Okay, well, here's the best thing that I ever learned, because you have to start somewhere with this when you're learning. And this is one of the most complicated parts of fly fishing for steelhead, because you never stop learning all the places they can be, because they can be anywhere, almost anywhere. You know, they're not going to hang suspended in the middle of a 17-foot vertical drop of falls, you know. They're not going to be there. They're not going to be in 3 inches of water, you know. So there's some places, obviously, where they're never going to be. But they can go anywhere they want to go. Okay, so what do you do when you're first starting with this then? You can't fish the whole river because you don't understand it, right? So what you want to remember is that steelhead are looking for two things when they come back into the river. They're looking for cover, and they're looking for protection from the heavy currents so they can rest as they journey. If you look for currents that are at least knee-deep, you know, say 3 feet, say 3 to 5 feet deep, and those currents are moving in a straight line, at the speed of a brisk walk, you're there. So 3 to 5 feet of water, currents moving in a straight line, about the speed of a brisk walk, they will be there. And that's the kind of stuff you should start looking for, because there's a lot of it around, and it's easy to see. You know, then later on, you start, and that is a big chapter in the book, and because it gets much more complicated than that. For example, a steelhead will also choose, when they're moving through the river, you know, they encounter all kinds of conditions, including pools and runs or riffles, whatever you call them, that may be less than ideal. So they may be in a place that doesn't have currents in a straight line, it isn't 3 feet deep, and isn't moving at the pace of a brisk walk, because those things aren't there. Okay? But there might be something that's still acceptable. See, so they're going to be looking for the most favorable spot, even if they can't find the absolutely perfect lie. So what that means then is your understanding of hydraulics grows over the years. They can be in water faster than a brisk walk, much slower than a brisk walk, deeper than 6 feet, less than 3 feet. You know, they can be in these different kinds of places. And you'll have to experiment. And after you've fished a place that you know looks perfect and you haven't caught anything or you've got some extra time, do some prospecting. You know, because they can literally be anywhere they want. In this part of the game, you will never, I haven't mastered it yet. I'm still surprised sometimes at the places where I'll find steelhead. One day I was standing at the edge of this pool. I'd fished through the best part of the run. I hadn't caught anything, so I walked back up to the head of the run, and I was going to change flies and go through the second time. Now, I'm standing in water that's not much more over my ankles, so I tie on a new fly. Okay, I'm in ankle-deep water, and I want to get the fly wet. It's dry, you know, I want the fly to sink. So I just take the fly, it's just a leader and 5 feet of line, you know, 10 feet, and I throw the fly down in the water to get the fly wet, and I get one. Okay, I landed that fish, I went back up there and I did that two more times. I took 3 fish out of a place that wasn't even up to my knees, you know, hardly any current in it at all, but the trigger was that it was almost dark. So there was a lot low, there wasn't much light on the river, and those fish could get in that really shallow water and still feel protected because it was getting dark, you see. So you'll never figure it all out. If only if you do.
You could write a whole other book on that.
We'll write another book on it.
Yeah, and I guess part of that is just you got to think about what's going on with them, because it's not like a trout that lives there, you know, all year round and has its favorite places to be. These guys and gals are moving up the river to get somewhere.
That's right. That's right. And your job is to intercept them on that journey. And they can, like I say, they can go anywhere, almost anywhere they want to. So if you look at a pool and it may not be ideal, but you can see one or two little places in there that are better than anything else in the immediate vicinity, man, put your fly out there. Because, see, they're always going to gravitate toward the most favorable lie. Even in lousy, fast, rushing water, you know, you can still find one if you look for the most favorable place. It may not be perfect, but it's better than anything else 50 feet in either direction. If they're going to be there anywhere in that run, they'll be there, you see. So these are the kind of things it takes experience and time to learn.
And when you say favorable, are we talking about resting areas? Or
mm-hmm.
are we talking about the same kind of place a trout would?
Some of them look exactly like a trout place. I gave a slideshow in a talk the other night to a Trout Unlimited group, and the guy said the hardest part for him was learning that he caught some steelhead in the same kind of places he caught trout, but other places they were in places that a trout wouldn't be. And that's because of the migratory nature of these things. See, they're not there to live and eat and grow old and die there. They're moving. So they've got to go through this bad water, you know, and they'll pick the path of least resistance, you see. So they can be almost anywhere. So when I say less than favorable, I mean, you know, maybe it's a little too fast. They'd rather have something slow. Maybe it's a little too shallow. Maybe it's not rocky enough or whatever. But they could be there for short periods of time. And that brings up a point. You see, there's two kinds of water. Well, you chase steelhead. One is called, I call it resting water, and that's just a little place where they pull over for maybe 20 minutes or half an hour or 10 minutes just to rest and collect themselves before they move on. They're temporary places, and they'll choose them that are less than favorable. The other kind is what I call holding water, and these are usually slower, deeper places where they're going to stay for days, weeks, and maybe even months, you see. So there's those two kinds of water types, and these less than favorable spots are temporary. They're just resting areas.
Now, tell us about, because we are running short on time here,
okay.
Tell us about some of the different presentations you might use and why you use them.
Well, the broadest sense of the word, I like a down and across swinging fly because it covers the most water in one single cast. And in the book, I've got one of my favorite chapters as I go into this. You know, I talk about indicator fishing and those kind of presentations, which I know how to do and I use them. And they require a lot more skill than a swinging fly do, but they're not as much fun. Basically, with a swinging fly, I look at presentations. They're one of two kinds. There's what I call a simple swing, where you throw the fly out there toward the center of the river, and it stays in the same place. It doesn't sink. It just swings along in a flat arc. You follow me? It just, you know, you throw it out there and the river pushes your line around. The fly swings around and it stays at the same depth. That's a simple swing. A compound swing is where you make the same cast, but the fly is not only swinging around, it's also dropping at the same time. Those are more difficult to orchestrate, but you need to do it, because not all the fish are going to come up for the surface and take a fly that's just swinging around in one horizontal plane. You know, you have to get the fly down to them. So you want to worry about your sinking fly presentations, and there's two ways to accomplish that. You can just simply change the density of your sinking tip and just use a faster sinking one, right? Let the line do the job all by itself, you know, so the fly begins to sink as it's swimming around. Or you can use a lighter density tip and make your presentation and then put some slack into the cast. Because when you put slack line on the water, it takes the pressure and the tension off of the line and the leader. That allows the fly to drop. Does that make sense? If you follow me. So when I think about my presentations, I'm worried about two things. The speed with which the fly swings across river, and you cannot fish it too slow, but you can fish it too fast. I'm worried about the speed with which the fly swings across the river, and I'm worried about how deep it is. The easiest way to manipulate those two variables is if the fly speeds up, you mend your line, right? If you want to get deeper, just put on a deeper tip to get your fly down. And then the slack line casting and stack mending and all this fancy stuff, you know, you can learn that later, but you have to be able to adjust the depth and the speed with which your fly fishes. That's critical.
Yeah, and you could be fishing some pretty heavy water, I take it, and getting that fly down, serious business.
Oh, yeah, it's a chore sometimes. That's right. We got lines that weigh almost as much as a small car. I mean, I don't like to use them. I mean, you know, they've got these lead lines. I don't like that kind of stuff, but it does the job. It gets me. Some of the best fishermen I know use fly lines that are lead. They're like lead clotheslines. Those flies get down in anything, and there's usually a fish or two there. So that's the easiest way to change the depth of your fly, is just put on a faster sinking tip. See, and that goes back to the relationship between your strategies and your lines, and the advantage of those lines that you can change the tips. I think that's the most important part of your gear out there, because it gives you more options for your presentation.
Okay. So it sounds, you know, it's really not too fancy when you think about it. You know, you have to switch up your lines when necessary to get it down deeper, but, you know, you don't have to be some fancy caster to go steelhead fishing.
No, you really don't. And that's part of the reason why I was drawn to the sport in the first place.
You're a lousy caster, Lonnie?
Yes, I used to be. Well, I still have my moments.
All have our moments.
Yeah, I don't want anybody watching when I hit myself in the back of the head. You know, I've got a whole series of casts I do like that. There's the shoulder blade stab. There's the earlobe rip. You know, I do them all. You know, especially during the wind. So, yeah, it's not the sport. The part of the magic of this, Roger, is it's there. It's for anybody. It doesn't matter, you know, what color of skin you are, what gender you have, how much money you do or you don't have, where you live, none of that matters. It's a sport that's open and available to anyone. It's an uncomplicated sport in some ways because, you know, the steelhead in some ways are an uncomplicated fish. They really are. And guys like me just earn something of a living by telling people otherwise, but the truth is it's not rocket science. You know, it just takes some observations. And I think we're running out of time, but I want people to know this. The most important thing that the really great anglers that I've had, that I fished with, had, is that they're not fishermen at all. They had lousy tackle, some of them. Some of them had great tackle. What matters is they're not fishermen at all. They're hunters. Anybody can do that. You know, you don't have to be a great caster. If you're not a great caster, then look for the places that you can cover.
And you know, you don't patient. Evolution.
Yeah, be patient. Stay focused. Be patient, and it'll happen. You know, you're not trying to figure out which calabatus they're hitting today. You know, that's not even in the game. Put on something orange and throw it out there, you know. And that's a lot of fun because that opens the door for imagination, for a sense of freedom and experimentation, you know, that I don't think any other kind of fishing has.
Well, good. Great way to end the show. But I do want to read a comment, and this was not a question, but just a statement of gratitude, as the man puts it. Because, Lonnie, this reflects on you personally, but it also, and I've never ended a show kind of like this, but it reflects on what we need to do and what effect it might have to the youth in coming up in our sport. But it's from Greg Felt in Salida, Colorado. And he says, when I was a kid growing up in Marin, my brother and I used to come to your shop, North Country Fly and Tackle. You got us going on fly tying, and we were patient and supportive of our efforts. It is a good lesson that we never know what sort of influence we may be having on a kid. I went on to an early career in whitewater with a strong float fishing component, and I am now the co-owner of Arc Anglers in Colorado's Arkansas River. I manage our guide service, about 2,400 guests a year, and my partner handles our retail shops in Salida, Buena Vista, and Pueblo. I have a real soft spot for kids who are making a start in the sports. Thanks for helping me get going, Greg Felt. So kudos to you, Mr. Waller, and what you did for some young kid at one point in time, I'm sure many. But I think that says what we all need to do in bringing our children along and kids. So.
I read that, and that meant a lot to me. I think, you know, in the end, fishing is a part of life, and life is a part of fishing. And for me, you know, in the book, I really take the opportunity to try to prove that to the reader. You know, when you go down to the water's edge, you should take all of your life with you. And when you leave the water's edge, you go back to your normal daily routine, you should take the lessons that you've learned on the river and from the natural world. The two are inseparable.
Great, great. Well, stick with us, folks. Unfortunately, we're out of time for more questions for Lonnie, but we are going to be giving away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And then we're also giving away a copy of Lonnie Waller's latest book, A Steelheader's Way. And whoever gets that tonight will get a real gem of a book. And that's courtesy of Headwater Books. So stay tuned to see if you win. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's Save Bristol, and that's Bristol, B-R-I-S-T-O-L, bay.org, to learn more and get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd truly appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and to win the first two, you must have registered on our site and be part of our database. And if you did that, then you have a shot at our drawing tonight. If you haven't done that already, it's a little too late now, but make sure you do it the next time around so you have a chance at one of these great prizes. So the first winner, and this is a winner of the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, is going to be Dana Eccles. Dana Eccles. So Dana, and Dana's in U.S., we will get in contact with you, and congratulations on that 3-year membership to the Federation. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. And our second winner for the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, which is out of Calgary, Canada. If you want to know more about that magazine, go to www.flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Brian Larrington, Brian Larrington, and Brian's in Wisconsin. So, again, congratulations, Brian. I'm sure you're going to enjoy that magazine. And then finally, now, our golden prize of the night, courtesy of Headwater Books, we're going to give away a copy of Lonnie's latest book, A Steelheader's Way. And to win this, you have to work a little harder. And to do this, you need to answer the question I'm going to ask. You need to be the first person to answer the question correctly and put in your name and your location. You do this in that text box on our homepage, same place you ask questions during the show. So fill that out, first person to send it in correctly, and I'll let Lonnie determine whether or not you've answered the question correctly, will win this book. During the show, we talked about tying flies And Lonnie talked about a specific hook that he uses now for tying flies. Describe that hook to me. It's a particular kind of hook. Describe it, and we'll see if you win. So, okay, now, Lonnie, we wait. We see how fast these people are.
I think they're probably pretty fast.
I know this guy, too. And he was fast.
He's already there, is he?
Yeah. Bill Butts in Springfield, Missouri says, actually, Bill's going to be a guest on our show down the road. He says, short shank offset hook.
That's correct. He's right.
That's right on, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. He was listening.
He was listening.
He probably uses them, that's why.
Yeah. Yeah. He fishes for a lot of striped and white bass, so he might be using them for those. But so congratulations, Bill. I'll be talking to you tomorrow as planned, and I'll get you. I already have your information, so we'll know where to send the book. So anyway, congratulations, and thanks for playing, everybody. Got to be fast out there. Got to be fast. Well, anyway, Lonnie, thanks so much for being on the show. I appreciate your valuable time, and I surely enjoyed it, and I know our folks will have enjoyed it. I learned a lot, so hopefully we can do something again sometime.
Thank you, Roger. I really enjoyed it. I had a good time with this, and I hope the people out there picked up something along the way as well.
Well, if it was nothing more than that offset bait hook, then that was a real gem right there. So, well, great. On our next broadcast, which will be on July 1st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to interview Charlie Craven, and our topic on that show will be fly tying techniques you can't do without. Charlie Craven is one of the best fly tiers and fly tying instructors you'll run into. No matter how much you know or how long you've tied, you'll be sure to learn a few more tips and techniques during this show. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, Pierre Marquette River Lodge, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.